Today's guest met a single mother with stage 4 breast cancer who was having trouble making rent. Did she give her a few bucks and hope that somehow she would make it? Not at all. Eve founded Cancer Angels of San Diego. We'll find out more about Eve and Cancer Angels in just a moment. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, and I am the host of Mind Talk, which is your daily source for relationship and mental health conversations. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Eve Butler. Eve, have I done your last name justice?
It's Butler, but everyone can say whatever they want since it doesn't look like how it sounds.
Well, how about we start with Eve Butler is a Perfect. Licensed marriage and family therapist. Eve, welcome to Mind Talk. Tell us about the day that you met this woman who really seemed to change your life and then the lives of so many after that.
Well, I actually met Georgia. I'll say her name because she wanted it out there for as long as it could be. She was actually working with me in my private practice in order to be able to deal with the cancer and to be able to deal with her daughter, who was having a hard time with her illness. And one day she just told me that the small charity that was helping her had sent her a letter and said that they could no longer provide funding for her. I was quite shocked at this because she had nowhere to go. And when I called this little charity, there were 12 women in this position, and that meant 12 women with children that were going to be put on the streets. And that whole thing was so appalling that my kids and my family and I, my friends, we just threw together a fundraiser in about 4 weeks, and we raised $33,000 and were able to keep 9 of the women in the home. 3 of them passed away, but we kept 9 of them in their home. However, as time went by, I realized that this charity was going to continue to be in that situation. So with a lot of tears and confusion, we decided to found Cancer Angels of San Diego, which would help not only breast cancer patients, but patients of any kind of cancer that were stage 4, men, women, whatever their needs were. We decided we needed to help everybody because it's an epidemic situation.
When you say that these women were about to be put out on the street, do you mean literally lose their homes, have no place to live while they're dealing with such a significant medical challenge?
Absolutely. And that's about, stage 4, I would say, is about 25% of the cancer population. And of that 25%, 68% of them are in this situation. And that's an appalling number. And when I first started, it was about 33%, and it rose to 45%. And now, with the economy being what it is, it's actually 68% of the cancer population faces financial devastation. And many of those, it means homelessness and actually starvation. We've had many patients that literally were not eating. Yeah, this is very literal. They were going to go onto the streets.
You know, it's almost hard to wrap your brain around it. We're living in America, which in theory is the land of milk and honey. Of course, we know that's not true. But just there's such a disconnect, it seems, between what people think of when they think of America and the fact that here are these people struggling with these clearly life-challenging, all-consuming in a lot of ways, illnesses, and they might be without food, without a bed to sleep in. It's just stunning.
Oh, yeah, it is stunning, and I do have friends from Europe, and when they visit, they're shocked, and they probably ask me the same question over and over again, which is, wait, people get sick, and they lose their homes and go on the street? They'll ask me that. And usually when I tell somebody, you know, an American about this, they will say to me at least 2 or 3 times, don't they have insurance? And I try to be kind and I say, yes, they have insurance, but let me go over this again, because they just cannot, as you say, wrap their heads around it. They can't believe that this is something that they themselves never even thought about, when it could be them. And that's the real scary part about it. And that's probably the biggest problem we have in reaching people, is that it hits so close to home.
Let's talk about just for a moment the issue of insurance, not from a political perspective, but the reality of having insurance available, but not as much as you need when you are dealing with a devastating medical issue. And the fact remains that insurance doesn't pay your bills. I mean, it doesn't pay your rent or your mortgage.
Right, right. Well, you know, most of our patients have some form of insurance. But they still have co-pays, most of them. Some of them don't, but most of them do. They still have large prescription bills. But, you know, some of them also want to take a vitamin or a supplement. Of course, they can't afford that. But bottom line is, when you get medical bills, the co-pays are going to wipe you out, especially if you're middle class and you have perhaps, you know, 80% coverage. Imagine 20% of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars that you owe. And it is the biggest cause of bankruptcy in this country, which people don't talk about either. I mean, we call our patients the forgotten patients because of this situation. And I would say probably 90% of people I talk to, unless they've been hit by cancer themselves or in their family and gone through the situation, are completely stunned and haven't thought about it.
Well, and even when you talk about copays, you know, the myth is that a copay, for some who don't know, the myth is that a copay is a couple of bucks. It's no big deal. All you have is a copay.
Right.
What are you complaining about? But you put it in an important perspective. If you've got a bill, a hospital bill for hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is easy for it to be, then
exactly.
A copay, it's so far away from a couple of dollars that it's mind-blowing.
Exactly. And it, I mean, a copay, we're not talking, you know, $20 or $5 when you go to see the doctor. You're talking a hospital stay, you know, can cost you $50,000, $60,000, $100,000. And look at the and that. So most people have to, you know, they often lose their insurance and get, you know, what we have, Obamacare or Medi-Cal, whatever's out there, because they cannot afford the copays. And, you know, they often don't pay them. And unfortunately, if you don't pay your medical bills, often you lose your treatment.
You know,
stunning.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's so many conversations we could have around just that issue alone. But I'd like to back up a bit. You indicated that you were working with a client. You, in fact, are a psychotherapist. You work with couples, marriages, and families, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So tell us a bit about, if you can, some of the typical, if typical is even the right word, kinds of situations that come up in a couple or in a family when a family member is at the place that they have stage four cancer.
Boy, there's a lot of problems for children involved. It makes it, you know, even more difficult. And one of the statistics that is really shocking is that for a woman with breast cancer or MS or pretty much any kind of cancer, her chances of her spouse leaving her are 6 times the national average. So if you get cancer and if you're sick, a lot of the times you will find yourself alone. So that's the first thing that makes this so difficult. And so you have a double grief, and then you also have, you know, a huge financial loss. And most of the issues that I deal with, they start out with, you know, the fear of the cancer, the illness. I do a lot of hypnosis and imagery, so I work with people to go inside of themselves and try to heal whatever they can, sleep better, get rid of their worries. But honestly, Dr. Brewer, the biggest stress people have, because we've done a lot of surveys on this, is financial and being a burden on their family. Because when we ask them, you know, what's your biggest fears? They don't say dying. I don't think I've ever seen that when I think about it. It's always financial. Am I going to lose my home? Where am I going to sleep? How am I going to feed my children? And that's the kind of things that I was working with that I also realized, you know, counseling is not going to help so much here. We need real practical answers to this. And since there's no resources after looking everywhere, somebody has to do something. And that's when Cancer Angels came to be, because I'd also lost my cousins and my best friend to cancer. And I realized that my mother went through this with her father during the time of the Depression. She lost her home and had to move into the back of the paint store. And I realized this is not a talking matter. This is something you have to do. So that's how this all transpired, was I got to do something. And here we have, you know, we've been here now for 10 years, and we started as an experiment.
Well, and an important, clearly life-saving experiment. You know, as you were talking about the number of people who are in relationships and then those relationship partners literally walk away, I was actually reminded of a woman I worked with many, many years ago. And her biggest issue was, as you say, that her spouse was really angry with her for having cancer. Really angry with her in terms of how she responded after chemo and was leaving. They were, you know, she was dependent upon him, which was a condition that he had created, interestingly enough, because she'd certainly worked outside of the home before they met and married. And her biggest concern was, where was she going to live?
Exactly. And that wraps it all up. You know, they don't even think about, oh, am I going to die? How am I going to get my treatment? They think about, how am I going to do this from the back seat of my car?
Right.
You know, and this is a national epidemic. This is just not in one county or another. I have a friend who works at Dana-Farber. People come in for bone marrow transplants. And in that freezing weather in the winter, they sleep in their cars.
It's enough to really take your breath away, just on so many levels. Yeah. Cancer Angels is now 10 years old, and you actually have, as you indicated, a number of family members who help you with this organization. Is that correct?
Yes, I have. My brother-in-law is a Nobel laureate, so he kind of looks over things. My husband comes from a family of physicians way back during, you know, Germany during the Holocaust. His grandmother was a physician back then. But one of the people who has raised the most money for us is my son, who actually was on The Bachelorette years ago, and he used his notoriety to raise money for charities. And so he got us a grant for about $115,000, and he just used, you know, his popularity to help us raise funds. And so that's how we really got more funds, was by my very giving and charitable son. His name is Kipton Locke. He was on the Jillian season. That was a long time ago, but he raised about $6 million for charities altogether.
Which is just extraordinary. And in doing my research, is it correct that you're a grandma now?
Yes, the love of my life. Don't get me going there. We'll never get back.
Okay, I'm not going to get you going there, except to say, what a cutie pie. The internet is amazing, and I just a cutie pie. All right, let's come back.
He helps me deal with this.
the impact. So you continue to work in your practice. You're also running this nonprofit, and you also, as I understand, provide pro bono counseling services to persons with dealing with stage 4 cancer.
Yes.
How do you navigate this?
It's a 24-hour job,
yeah.
Really.
How do you navigate this for yourself? I mean, you're clearly in this in so many ways.
You know, it's difficult. Right now I have 4 or 5 volunteers that are just priceless and are helping me and have kept me going. And what I try to do is just keep things balanced. And, you know, after so many years of doing therapy and so much loss in my own life, I'm pretty tough. You know, I try not to get emotionally drained. And also, you know, the thing is, Dr. Brewer, is if we have money, I'm Mrs. Santa Claus. You know, it's a great feeling because you can stop evictions, you can save lives. It's when we don't have money that I feel pretty sick inside. And it's hard to navigate because then I see these massive amounts of money going to other nonprofits where I know the money isn't going to the patient, or, you know, just in all kinds of ways where money is going. And we still have this population of people right next door to us. And that, for me, gets me down.
Sure.
But if we have funds, I can deal with it fine because, you know, you can, it's not a stress you don't have control over then. It's something you have control over, and you can actually watch these people live longer because all of our patients tell us when we stop helping them, they stop treatment. And that's the burden right there.
Absolutely. And it's not just, and just is certainly the wrong word here, but it's not that rent or mortgage assistance is the only thing that you provide. There are other things that are perhaps smaller, but truly huge in the lives of the folks you're helping. What are some other examples of assistance that Cancer Angels has been able to provide?
Well, besides all the basic necessities, food, rent, utilities, getting to, you know, fuel to get to treatment, we do request during Thanksgiving so that people have food for Thanksgiving dinner. Sometimes we deliver it. And we always do request during the holidays for the children and also when they go back to school for clothing, for school supplies, all those kind of things that they wouldn't have. And sometimes I'll put on my Facebook, you know, Jane Doe would like to play soccer like the rest of the kids. This, can somebody donate, you know, $200 so that this child can go play soccer? It's her only relief. You know, it's all that they have. And all these things that we take for granted, these people don't. Because, you know, remember, all these people, they were not what you consider in the poverty level. They were middle class. These were people that were hardworking, middle-class people who are not in our system. They don't receive any kind of EBT card or any HUD housing. They don't receive anything because they worked all their lives. So their children were in all of these things, and then it's just gone. I mean, even like going out to Applebee's, that would be a huge privilege for some of them, which often I do, but I just do it on my own pocket. That's where I take my private practice funds. Is I'll get some food cards or, you know, some special things like that for some of these children. So that's the kind of little things we do that the kids are just so grateful for, and it just pulls them through.
And, you know, it's interesting that you make the comment that many of the folks that you're helping were middle-income families, so they were not used to having to reach out and ask for help and weren't in the system to automatically get the help. Does the system, right, as their finances begin to dwindle and their resources drain, is there any part of the system that they can automatically access? Is there anything available?
Sadly, no. And one of the biggest problems that we face is most people, no matter how sick they are, cannot get disability the first time they apply. So now you have a situation where there's no funds. Getting an EBT card, if you get social, you know, you get SDI, which is, you know, state disability, and you don't have children, you don't qualify for a food card. So you're talking people who may have high mortgages or their rent is, you know, sometimes $1,500, you know, $2,000. And all of a sudden, they have nothing and they don't even know where to begin. You know, something that we really need and I'm always trying to get is somebody to go in and navigate the system for them, to help them reduce costs, maybe sometimes to help them move because they just have no idea. And, it, you know, two things that play into here, into this situation, emotional things are number one, shame. They feel embarrassed to have to ask for help, even though it's no fault of their own whatsoever. It's not something they did to themselves. And number two, they have denial. They just can't believe that this cancer is going to last so long. They first of all, they have to adjust that they have cancer, which is really hard for them. And second of all, when they learn that it's stage four, they either think they're going to die immediately or they're going to get better immediately. And the truth is, if you have stage four cancer, you have a chronic disease, and it can last anywhere from a year to, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. But that's the biggest problem.
Which, again, is, you know, you're giving us so much good information that I know that people don't think about when actually we think about anything, but certainly, you know, more and more people are understanding that the sooner you're able to get treatment, the better your potential for recovery and longevity. But, you know, at stage four, I think a lot of people just assume, as you said, well, I know a lot of people just assume, I mean, you've just verified it. One thing, you know, the two extremes, and neither one are necessarily the case, which would add right. to the sense of confusion and shame about what to do next and where do I go. I'm sure Eve Beutler, licensed marriage and family therapist, founder of Cancer Angels. We're going to take a break, Eve. But when we come back, I'd love it if you could share with us some of the stories, some of the lives of the folks that you've met and been able to help, even in the tiniest way, which is often feels like the biggest way for them.
Great.
Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. We will be back in just one moment. Before you share with us some of the stories of people you've helped, tell us about the decision to focus on those with stage four cancer versus the earlier stages.
Well, the reason we chose stage four is because by that time, some of them are diagnosed immediately, but often it's been years or months that they get there. But by that time, the number of people that are in a terrible financial situation is enormous because of all the co-pays, because of all of that. And also because, you know, lovely Irma Bombeck used to say, you know, we don't use the word terminal. That's only for bus stations. And she's so right, because stage four is not a terminal diagnosis. It's something that can last forever. And basically, we chose stage four because we knew we could really help in that area, not only to keep, you know, people in their homes and alive, but to give them the perspective that, you know, they're not going to die tomorrow, that they have to see it as a chronic illness. And that's one of my specialties, because I have a very rare lung disease, and I've been there, and I'm doing great now and have faced that, you know, terminal diagnosis. And so we chose stage four because we knew we could make the biggest impact there. And also because I truly believe that it's a matter of buying time right now. And when you're stage four, if you know that there's another treatment right around the corner, you're going to keep fighting for life. And when you have little kids and you're young, you want to fight for life. And people do.
The idea that some folks have that the day that they finally go to a physician and get a diagnosis, you know, oftentimes the expectation, I think, is, well, I'm just going now, so the diagnosis is, if I have a diagnosis, it's going to be stage one, or it's going to be stage two, usually stage one. And I just think about the shock and the confusion for somebody whose first cancer diagnosis is stage four. Does that happen often?
Right. Oh, it happens all the time. In fact, I had just lost my cousin 2 weeks ago. She had gone in for a breast cancer exam in June. Her breasts were too dense to see. They said, well, don't worry about it. And in January, she had metastatic cancer everywhere. And you can imagine the shock from don't worry about it to metastatic breast cancer everywhere. And you can't even absorb it, because you don't feel that bad. And I have another cousin who had something called carcinoma unidentified primary. And these kind of cancers, they're just aggressive and quick, and you don't know how to deal with it. And other people, you know, they go in with stage four, and the doctor will say, don't worry, it's not the end of your life. We have lots of treatments, and we're going to take it day by day. But no matter who you are, you're still in shock.
Right, right. And the word stage four still resonate, period, end of story.
Right, right. And they interpret that as, a terminal diagnosis. I most people write to me and say, hi, I have terminal cancer. I call them right away and I say, we don't use that word. And actually, I have a lot of letters from people saying, boy, I'm glad you got me straight because I had given up. And sometimes it's a matter of them of getting them from one treatment center to another. And luckily, I've gotten to know all the treatment centers, and I know where the research is, and I know where the clinical trials are. And everything changes when they have hope.
Absolutely. Give us an example of some of the, tell us about some of the folks that you've, the Cancer Angels has been able to help.
I actually have in front of me, Dr. Brewer, a letter we got last night. I have a very long letter from another woman that I can, you know, shorten. And I think reading it in their words might be the most helpful. Would that be okay?
That would be fine, yes.
Some of these little short things?
Yes.
Okay, we got one last night from a friend, from a client who we've given, I think he's gotten 2 months' rent and food and gas cards. And I have a beautiful volunteer. Her name is Sheila. And she herself has cancer. She has a chronic kind of cancer, and she gets very sick sometimes. But when she's well, she works with us. And she's just incredible with these patients. So he's written this letter to her and to me, even though it really belongs to everybody that donates. So I'm going to just read you a little bit of this letter.
Great.
It was really moving for me. Sheila, I apologize for the delay in sending you and Eve this heartfelt letter of gratitude. And thanks for your help with the rent, food, and gas. It overwhelms me that I am worthy of such charity and generosity. From the bottom of my heart, I thank you and Eve for the countless ways in which you help not only me, but others as well. May the Lord watch over you, and may he bless you for all your good works. As you know, I've been struggling these days. The side effects are causing my intestinal wall to thicken almost 4 times normal. It's very painful. I hope I'm starting to recover from the perpetual flu-like symptoms, yet the symptoms return and are both frequent and vivid. At times, I entertain how nice it would be to be well, and I keep myself buoyant with thoughts such as these. However, to fear each morning with the sickness, the severe nausea and endless bitter taste in the mouth, the burning in the veins, it becomes difficult. It's only because of people like you and others that I'm able to endure. For this, I am most grateful. I recall that you said your numbers, he's talking about Sheila, are in good stead, and I pray that you continue on your path of good health. It's recovery stories such as yours that urge me to carry on. I know this is a very rough patch for me, but God be willing, it will pass soon. When we spoke, I wasn't exactly lucid, as you can imagine. That means he was in the hospital and very sick.
Okay.
I look forward to hearing from you, and please pass along my heartfelt gratitude and appreciation to Eve. I'm so moved by the work you both do. It makes such a very big difference. Please know that it truly does. Your friend Miguel. So we got that last night.
That's
just one of our examples.
That's incredible.
Yeah, this man's quite the writer, huh?
Yeah. And again, I mean, just the power of your ability and Sheila's ability to connect with him. In this way, because as you well know, there are people who hear illness of any kind. There are people who look at you and see a broken limb and say, I got to stay away. That's too much. I don't want to deal with it. So there's just so much that goes in the give and take, as you well know. But I do want to underscore it for the listeners, for the volunteers, of which you were one, working with these individuals. Do you have another story you'd like to share with us?
I have in front of me, this is a current patient. This is a family. It's the father that has the cancer. And the mother has 3 boys, and she has sent us just amazing pictures of the boys in bed in the hospital bed with their father, fighting for him. So I'll try to just give you little samples of it.
Great.
This is from Sylvia. Our story started in 2012 when my husband got diagnosed with brain cancer. Little did we know how much our lives were going to change. My name is Sylvia, and my husband's name is Sergio. We have 3 wonderful boys, 17, 12, and 10 years old. When my husband was first diagnosed, we thought it was going to be a fast and easy process. We thought he's just going to have surgery and all this nightmare will be over. 5 years later, and we've been through so much together, my kids have experienced things that adults in their whole lifetime will never have to experience. She then goes on to speak to how her husband was so strong, the provider, and what happened to him with his hospital visits and how it's impacted her children. And, you know, it's a very long letter talking about it. And then she says, after 32 sessions of radiation with so many side effects after radiation, they sent us home and said that it would be at least 5 years for them to even notice any kind of growth in his cancer. But it took less than 1.5 years after an MRI. They called us back in again saying it looked like the cancer was spreading and he was going to have to start chemotherapy. I had no job. He wasn't working, and we've been struggling to pay our bills in a rent in a decent place to live. Our children have been through so much, and the only parent, and any parent, I'm sorry, it's all went on here, the only thing a parent wants is the best for their children. And sometimes we feel like we've let them down because they have to be in this journey with us. But they're such good kids and so grateful to still have their father around that they always try to help him and be there for him. You know, at the end, she says,
No, please continue.
Go ahead. She says, I have no words. It brings tears to my eyes because I'm so grateful that Cancer Angels has helped us so much. When we felt like we had no hope for our financial situation, still having to go through all this, and my husband just finishing chemotherapy after a year to the month and hospitalized again. Let me skip all this other very depressing stuff. I was worried about telling how I was going to tell my children about this. And then she goes on and says, just thank you for sending us the rent and keeping us in our home and keeping us alive. And that's very typical of what we get from the parents with children.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that, and again, I think it's something that from the outside looking in, one might not even think about, is the guilt that parents will have about the impact of the illness and just the change in their daily living activities on the children.
Yes. In fact, I have, I actually don't know if this person is still alive. I spoke with her maybe 2 weeks ago. And she has a teenage son. He was a senior in high school, a star volleyball player. And she couldn't work outside the home at all at this point. And she's the main breadwinner, a single mom. And she literally wouldn't buy her pain pills. She wouldn't do anything. And she would give up eating so that she could keep up this front for her son that things were okay. And I would keep saying to her, you know, honey, you've got to let him know what's going on. He's got to be able to help somehow. But nope, she wouldn't do it. She would drive to his volleyball places as long as she could. I myself paid a couple times for a hotel for her to stay there because it was something she felt that no matter what, she didn't want his life to change. And that's, you know, that's what a parent goes through. And they're sick. But, you know, their children come first. So the shame and trying to keep it all normal is just overwhelming.
What do you recommend to parents of children when they've got something, when they've got stage four cancer? Do you recommend they keep up a front, they keep it quiet, or what do you suggest?
Well, depending on the age of the child, you know, a teenager, I wanted her to be very honest with him because he was going to step out of, you know, high school, go into college and be in for a big shock. But depending on the age of the child, I'll recommend different things. But usually I just tell them to let the children know that it's going to be a long sickness, that it's not, you know, their fault or has nothing to do with them, that the best that they can do is just to be, you know, continuing in their lives, doing well in school. You know, it does come to a point where they're in hospice and we have to change the conversation. And also when we talk to them about the financial things, it's a very delicate situation. And I would say that each case is different depending on the child, depending on how many children, depending on how much Cancer Angels can help. If we can help them to put food on the table and to stay in their home, the parent doesn't have to tell them anything. They know something's going on when people show up with clothes or when they take a little card to Walmart and buy a bunch of clothes with it. The children know something is going on, but they kind of see it like, you know, Christmas or something that somebody is buying them presents. They don't really put the two things together that mommy and daddy, or just mommy or just daddy, are financially struggling.
Is there a limit to the length of time once you take a client on that you're able to work with him or her?
And the answer to that is no. As long as they are sick and as long as they're unable to work and financially destitute, we help them. And that's why I say we're an experiment, because we're the only charity in the country that does this. And of course, it was the inspiration from Georgia, the first patient, that keeps us committed to that. Because if you take away their funds, they're just going to give up and die. And since I talk with every patient every single month and I check in with the doctors, I know they're sick. And once you take away their rent, they're done. Or their food, they're done. And so we don't put a limit on it. We just keep real close tabs on their situation, other resources, and that kind of a thing. Because, you know, of course, we always have a waiting list. But we don't put a limit on it because that limit creates so much stress. It basically quickens the cancer, to be honest.
So if somebody comes in and you tell them, and you had to tell them, we're only going to work with you for 4 months, that's going to add to their stress. But if you say, we're going to be here as long as you need us, that's very different.
Right. It's that, and that is what doesn't exist in the country. And, I never thought we'd be able to do this. We thought, you know, we'll start out with, we'll only help a few people, but we'll do it with quality help. But, you know, after doing it for so long, you kind of look at their financial statements, their income from Social Security, and you're able to figure out the bare minimum to feed them, to keep the rent going. You know, and it is just the bare minimum. There's no extras here. You know, those people that wanted the supplements, they can't get those supplements anymore. But to know that there's going to be food on the table, lights on and heat on, and they're not going to have to sleep in their car, they will keep fighting to live.
Now, what about the organizations, the large organizations that folks are used to hearing about with respect to cancer? Do those organizations help to provide funding assistance? Are they information only?
Well, some of the, you know, the almost all of those charities, first of all, that are local, send their patients to us. We get referrals from the American Cancer Society, from Susan G., from the Pancreatic Society. Everybody sends their patients to us because those organizations are either informational or they focus on research. And, you know, research from, you know, all different sources is what provides the treatment to keep them alive, but it doesn't help them live. And only 32% patients. Cancer population can actually continue treatment for as long as they might be able to if they had the funding, which again is, you know, it's the 32 after the 68% that don't have the money, but no other charities will give them consistent help. Sometimes you have some that will give them, $1,200 here. Actually, there is one other charity that I will say was my mentor. This charity is called Breast Cancer Angels. And they were founded by Faye Dedeker. They're in Orange County, and they work with women with breast cancer of any stage. This one was my mentor, and just incredible. And they will continue help for as long as they need it. But it's only breast cancer.
Okay.
So we're different because we treat all patients. But that's the only other charity in the country that I know of.
Now, there are certainly people who are looking for alternatives to the traditional approach to cancer. Can they come to you for assistance, or does it have to be folks who are following a traditional cancer treatment path, if you will?
Dr. Brewer, that is a very good question and kind of a thorn in my side. So I will try to answer it as respectfully as possible. Complementary treatment, Western and alternative, is a great thing. I have had many patients who have been preyed upon and their entire life savings on non-traditional treatments that don't work, including a very beloved cousin of mine who went down to Mexico. And I watched her die very slowly. So you can imagine how I feel about that. The thing is, they don't have funds for this. They're not covered by insurance. And yes, chemo can make you sick. Depression can make you tired and sick. But the truth is that when somebody says, a physician says, I'm sorry, I don't have anything else for you, or they say, I do have treatment for you, they mean that. And I have never discovered an alternative treatment that has kept anyone alive as long as the traditional treatments, especially in this country. I mean, some of them might, like my chicken soup might help them, you know, counteract the side effects, but it's not going to stop the cancer. So anybody that spends money on alternative treatments or hundreds of dollars on supplements, we actually put that into the financial statement as income. We cannot pay for people who are spending a fortune on something we know or believe is not in their best interest.
Interesting.
That's the truth.
All right. Eve, we're going to take a break and we will come back. I'd like to hear about an award that has been given to Cancer Angels. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
The American Society for Radiation Oncology, which is referred to as ASTRO, has awarded Cancer Angels one of its Survivor Circle grants. What's that Survival Circle grant about? And congratulations.
Oh, thank you. Every year, this organization will choose the best charities they feel from wherever they're holding their meeting. This year, they were holding their meeting in San Diego and sent out requests for people to apply for grants. And I filled out some forms on the internet, sent them over to our website, and very quickly, they chose to give us this award, which was an $8,500 grant, and was just a tremendous acknowledgement. And of course, it planted so many seeds and brought so much awareness. So we are deeply grateful to them. And a lot of has come out of that, like speaking with you. So that was just a wonderful thing.
If for people who are listening, as I understand it, Cancer Angels, that's it. You are, other than the caveat that you gave us a bit ago, you're the only organization in the country providing the services as you do. What if someone wants to create a Cancer Angels in their location? Do you have recommendations for a place for them to begin to even think about this?
If anybody, and I'll make this very public, if anybody in any county wants to start a Cancer Angels, I am there. I will mentor them. I will give them all the forms they need. I'll show them how to create their own 501c3, or we can create an umbrella extension. We actually are holding the website Cancer Angels USA because it's necessary everywhere, you know, in some places more than others. But we are happy to mentor them and to get them started. We're also happy if somebody wants to raise funds for somebody in their own county, we will support them with all the materials they need and anything they need. And also they can use our 501c3, you know, in California and in other places. We just have a few, you know, hoops to jump through to provide funds for the patients in their area. We have worked in LA and in Orange County in order to help people. So that is my dream, is to make this, number one, a national organization where people can get help anywhere. And of course, number two, something that I can't put my energy into, but would love someone to do that, is we need to lobby to get help for this. Because I don't really think this should be, you know, not to get political, but it's not really the job of little charities. This should be something that is a national awareness when it's 68% of cancer patients. It just doesn't really make any sense that there's no safety net for these people. I mean, and who can live on a disability payment of $600 to $900 a month?
Not many people.
Yeah, and anyone who wants to start it and be as crazy as I am, I'm there. I'll help them.
How do folks get in touch with you?
It's all volunteer, you know?
I hear you. How does one get in touch with you? Is there an email address?
Right through the website. Yeah, they can contact me at eve@cancerangelsofsandiego.org. Make sure it's angels and not angles, because a lot of people do that naturally on the internet. So I don't get those emails. And I will reply right away and be happy to guide them. And, you know, if they can go to the local oncologist or to the hospital and say, do you have some patients who are in need of financial help? Most often, the doctors don't know. The doctors don't ask this question. I think, you know, it's too overwhelming for them, and also they're focused on treatment. But the social workers are beginning to ask. I mean, it's something that people don't want to talk about. But if you're in the chemo room and you're getting chemo and you don't feel well, usually you won't get asked, when you leave here, are you going into a home? Are you going into your car? Or are you sleeping in the park bathroom? I've literally pulled people out of bathrooms in parks that are sick with cancer. And that's not even in our discussion, again, because of the denial. So, boy, if we could build this awareness, like through your wonderful show, anybody who wants to help a patient in their area, I can assure you there are countless patients waiting for help. I have a woman right now. We've had her for 9 years. Her daughter was about 7 when they first came to us. So I'm not sure she'll be with us next month, but when you look at the child going from 7 to 16, and we've kept this person in her home all these years and fed her, that's a story that I want people to think about, because, you know, you look at how much money that must have cost. It's a lot of money.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think, but then you have to ask yourself, what's the value of a life? What's the value of a mom or a dad? And that's where we get into, when we apply for grants, we have to explain ourselves. We have to say, yes, we could have bigger numbers. We could have thousands and thousands of people we help, but we will help them poorly, and it mm-hmm. won't do what we do. So we don't have the big numbers, but when you look at all the people that we have and how the children have had parents for so much longer, I feel really good about that, because we don't put a number value on a human life. And that's a story that I really want people to think about, because we've raised probably over 10 years about $1.5 million, which when you look at the big, you know, nonprofits, that's really nothing. But when you look at how many lives have been impacted and how many children grew up with a parent instead of without a parent, that's what's important. It's about the quality of life, the dignity, and the fact that a person will fight to live if they have their dignity, they have their home, and they know the children are okay. And that's what we want to bring home to everybody.
And you're right, there's so much that very often we just take for granted. We assume that if somebody's sick, they're going to their home. We don't assume that they're going to their car or a park bench.
Right.
Well, what about families where the children have cancer? What happens in that situation?
Uh-huh. Well, we applied for a grant to be able to help children. We didn't get it. And honestly, I have to tell you, I was relieved. I lost my niece when she was 4 to glioblastoma, and that is absolutely the worst. For children that have cancer and the parents are impacted by it, to be honest, Dr. Brewer, there's nobody. There's a couple of charities that help them on a one-time basis. There's a charity in L.A., I can't remember the name right now, but it's also a one-time basis. It's a population that's completely ignored. And I would like to be able to do something with that someday, and would love it if somebody would, because these families, you know, having watched my sister-in-law go through this, and she's a physician, These families are really hurting. And of course, she couldn't work outside the home as a physician. She was with her daughter every minute. And can you imagine a single parent in that situation with a sick child? There's nothing, to be honest. There's just nothing at all.
And you know, I think about the unfounded guilt that family members feel, particularly when there's a child who's ill.
It's the worst.
Absolutely.
I think that's why I'm able to work in this situation, because I remember, I hope I don't lose it here, but when my cousin was dying, she said to me, Eve, I can't, there's nothing worse than this. This can't be happening. And I just looked at her and I said, Terry, it could be your son, which is a terrible thing to say. But honestly, what's worse than a child that suffers?
It's true.
Yeah.
It's really true.
When, I wish somebody would do that, because it's deeply, deeply needed.
When the family has a child with cancer, you know, ever so often we see these promos on television about children who are being treated at a hospital specifically for children with cancer. What's your sense of that service, and does that help?
Well, you know, I'm a big fan and donor to St. Jude's. I have one of my friends, Dr. Kuzrock from Moores, has told me wonderful stories about that hospital and how they treat everybody. They actually, you know, if you can't pay, they will treat you. However, once you leave the hospital, you're on your own again.
Okay.
And again, there's treatment and there's help for these children, but there's not financial help. And, you know, particularly single parent families, there's no finances. And imagine one of the parents leaving and having, you know, a nice home. And then all of a sudden you have, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars worth of medical bills and you don't have any income anymore. So these children are all in this terrible situation. And I have looked all over the internet for help and I haven't found it. So if your wonderful show can bring this out there, and anyone wants to get out there and do a grassroots charity on it, I will support you all the way, you know, especially having been through it. So that's a very good question you ask.
How does one, or how do you approach helping family members with the completely understandable depression that's going to crop up? Certainly by stage four, if it's not already firmly in place. How do you deal with that? How do you approach that?
Well, the first thing that I do is I validate that they're not alone. Almost everybody that comes to us feels that they're the only person in the situation. And, of course, they're embarrassed about it. They're angry and they're depressed. So when I give them the statistics and tell them what we do, a huge burden is lifted off of them, because then they realize, whoa, this is not my fault. This is a gap in the system that people like me, which there are, you know, millions, are in the situation. Then what I do is I try to divide their depression into practical and emotional. And I do that in my practice all the time. I divide, you know, everything. Do I have some control, no control, or a lot of control? And then we can work step by step through these things. And usually, once their financial situation is taken care of, they do pretty well. And as one of my patients, I was very close to her, just lost her 2 weeks ago. As she would used to say was, you know, a day above ground is a good day. And that's how most of them feel, that if they have a good day, it's a really good day. And most of them are not depressed. And if they are depressed, they're usually on antidepressants that the doctor's giving them.
Okay. You know, I know I asked you this earlier, but I just have to go back to at least an acknowledgement of how much joy there is for you in being able to help so many people who, but for Cancer Angels, would have no place to go. But I am also just so struck by the number of losses that are built into doing this kind of work, and what you have to deal with just on your own personal basis. I mean, it's kind of astounding.
You know, Dr. Brewer, I sometimes I think, boy, have you gotten numb? How are you doing this? And then I'll lose somebody in my own life and I'll realize I'm not numb at all. And I have lots of friends that have cancer and I make my chicken soup for them and I do on-hand things. But I have to say that my husband once said to me when I had a dear friend, 15-year-old girl who had cystic fibrosis, she was the youngest double transplant recipient years ago, he would say to me, why are you so close to her? Why are you doing this? You know it's going to kill you if she dies. And she did die, and it was terrible. But I feel so much strength, and I guess it's a spiritual sense that I have the ability to be with people who may be on their way out, if you want to call it. I think it's a lot because of my own faith, and I don't know what exists, but I do believe that life doesn't end. I couldn't give you any idea of what there is afterwards, but because of my own illness, I have actually experienced some, you know, afterlife experiences, and I just have such a belief that this beautiful soul is not going to end, that it gives me strength to get through the time with them. And it also makes me feel comfortable, or gives me comfort, to know that I'm probably one of the few people, if not the only person, that this person can talk to about dying. And, you know, I have visions of Lori, who passed away 2 weeks ago, sitting at a restaurant and seeing her eat one of her last meals and talking about her life and where she may be going, and just knowing that she could do that with me. So that's how I deal with it. And that's why it would be harder with children, you know, because some of these people are older, or, you know, I think our average age is probably about 50 or 60. Cause we have a lot of young ones. It takes a toll, but I'm just, you know, glad I can be there.
Eve Beutler, who is founder, president of Cancer Angels of San Diego, a marriage and family therapist when she's not wearing the other hat, although I think you wear all those hats all at once. I have to tell you how profoundly impressed I am and pleased to have been able to talk to you and to meet you in this way. Would you give folks your contact information one more time?
Certainly. Our phone number is 760-942-6346. Our website is cancerangels.org. And my email is eve@cancerangels.org. And Dr. Brewer, I will also tell you something else that keeps me going is that I'm a musician and composer, and that's where I get my strength.
Good for you.
That's where I get my passion, is I have a direct line to another level of this universe that puts music in my head. So I'm being taken care of.
Excellent. I'm very pleased to hear that. Eve, again, my pleasure, my honor to have been able to spend this time with you. Thank you again so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us here today. Mind Talk is available to you on demand at myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional of your choosing. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to hear from you. If you would like to just drop an email to me, you can do so by going to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.